You're listening to Finding Your Genius Zone with Dirk Novell. With the help of successful individuals across industries, Dirk breaks down the unknown parts of every vocation while highlighting the importance of finding a career where you can leverage your natural skills, passions, and interests. Now here's your host, Dirk Novell.
Everyone, this is Dirk Novell. Welcome to my podcast. On with me is a friend of mine, Edmund Allen. Edmund, welcome.
Hey, thank you, Dirk. Really appreciate you having me, my friend.
Yeah, and it's funny. Edmund, I know, is the name you go by in your profession, but I know you as Eddie or Ed. Ed is a good buddy of my brother's. So I think you went to Santa Clara with John. Is that right?
We did. I got to know your brother. He's one of my best friends, by the way. Playing football against him in high school. Yeah. And then he and I started Santa Clara together. He played football there, obviously. I did not, but I got to be great friends with him. Still one of my great friends. And obviously think the world of you too.
Thank you, buddy. By the way, where'd you go to high school?
I went to Blanchette.
Okay.
So I grew up in the East Side, went to Sacred Heart in Bellevue, and then went over to Blanchette. And that was right about the time East Side Catholic was starting. So I started at Blanchette, stayed there.
Okay. I think isn't that where Lampkin went?
Yeah, exactly. All the Lampkins went there.
Yeah. So the youngest Lampkin and I, he's one of my best friends, Steve. But anyway, hey, so Edmund is an attorney, criminal defense, trial, personal injury. I'm going to let him kind of fill in the blanks on kind of what type of law he practices. But Edmund, why don't you get into a little bit about, like, if you were to meet somebody on an airplane or at a restaurant or a bar and someone's like, what do you do? How would you answer that?
So, you know, you tell somebody you're an attorney, general response is, hey, kind of what kind of law do you practice? Or what do you do? Where do you work? You know, I would describe myself as a criminal defense attorney. I do a fair amount of personal injury work, largely trial work, litigation, a lot of traffic insurance related issues, but a fair amount of just general practice things. And I've got a good network of folks around town who practice in most other areas of law. So if I've got someone that calls about a property issue, a contract issue, an employment issue, I like to be able to refer them to people I know and kind of help them out that way as well. I can tell you kind of a little bit about my background. After I finished Santa Clara, I went to law school at Seattle University, and then I was a prosecuting attorney with the city of Kent for 3 years. And then I was a King County deputy prosecuting attorney for 8 years from 95 through 2003. And that's kind of what gave me my background in criminal law, having, you know, been a prosecuting attorney all those years. And, you know, I like that. We can talk about that a little more if you're interested. But, I didn't go to law school to work for the county forever. And after having gotten, you know, a lot of enjoyable experience, I decided to go out on my own into private practice. And I've been in private practice just on my own, you know, the last 19 years. But to kind of get back to your question about somebody asked you what you do, having been a former prosecuting attorney for 11 years, that kind of informs my practice. And I got to know that area pretty well. So that is kind of how I segued into that field.
Okay. So obviously this is common language for you, but when you say prosecuting attorney, like, tell me if I'm messing this up, but you work for the county and you were the one that went after people that were in trouble. Like, you were representing government or the county. You weren't representing a client. You were representing a larger entity. Is that accurate?
100% accurate. So unlike a civil case where one individual or one business will sue another individual or business, when somebody's charged with a crime, they're charged by the government with a criminal offense. And that can be, you know, when I worked for the city of Kent, I was prosecuting misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors that occurred in the city of Kent, representing the city of Kent. Municipal courts or district courts have jurisdiction over misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors, but not felonies. The county, through the King County Prosecutor's Office, has jurisdiction to prosecute, you know, misdemeanors as well as all of the felonies in the county. So when I moved to the King County Prosecutor's Office, I was representing the state of Washington through the King County Prosecutor's Office, prosecuting people for, you know, felonies.
So just to give us an idea, like, we're talking murder.
I had a number of homicide cases. I never had a homicide case that actually went to a jury trial. Lots of drug cases back when the sensibilities on prosecuting drug cases were different than they are now. A lot of the robberies and shootings and stabbings and assaults, a lot of fights. I prosecuted felony domestic violence cases for almost 2 years, and a lot of pretty severe, unfortunate, sad situations that I prosecuted, but, you know, some pretty ugly violence against primarily women over the years. But, you know, some kidnappings and some aggravated assaults and court orders. Saw a lot of sad situations. Yeah. But definitely took comfort and fulfillment and kind of seeing the right thing be done and then prosecute people for, you know, ugly crimes they've committed.
So I'm thinking, okay, here you are, Santa Clara, Seattle U. I want to get into it in a little bit. I know we talked a little bit about your father, I think, was in this world, and regarding that book that I read years ago. But like, when you get into this, into the legal profession, do you have like an interest, like, I want to be a prosecutor, or do you go to law school, get an internship, and then just kind of gravitate? Because it's like, I work with divorce attorneys. I work with real estate attorneys. I mean, there's many types of law that you can practice. Why did you jump into the world you jumped into?
You know, Dirk, that's really a great question. It varies quite a bit for different people. Certain people, you know, a lot of people talk about going to law school. Hey, you know, it's good background, might not necessarily practice law. You know, some of the ones go to certainly the Ivy League schools, the top portion of their class. They'll oftentimes look to interview, intern, and then get jobs with some of the bigger firms around town. You know, those pay the higher salaries, a little more prestigious sometimes, you know, certainly a grind with large hourly billable quotas. Others are drawn into, you know, helping the underprivileged, helping those wrongfully accused. Others have, you know, passion for environmental causes or international causes. With me in particular, you know, my dad had been a prosecuting attorney for King County and, you know, enjoyed that. And I enjoyed hearing about his murder trials over the years. And, you know, he gave me a lot of good pointers along the way. And so I, for that reason, was kind of intrigued by being a prosecutor, being in trial, and doing a lot of kind of high stakes criminal trial work. So that was what kind of got me going in that direction. But, you know, you get to a point in your career where, well, I want to do this forever. And honestly, you know, back-to-back-to-back felony trials, when I was in my late 20s, early 30s, you know, I kind of thought nothing of it. But, you know, after a while, that kind of wears on you a little bit. And frankly, I wanted the opportunity to go into private practice and be my own boss, do my own thing, and have more incentive, you know, quite frankly, to do a little better than the county salary I was making, which was, you know, which was fine, but it's a little stressful knowing that that's your salary and that's kind of the most you can do.
Yeah, no, I get it. I'm just kind of putting myself in like a 24, 25, 26, I don't know, in mid 20s, late 20s. And I'm, let's just say I'm really interested in law. And I'm trying to figure out, okay, what am I naturally good at? Like, what differentiates me from my other buddies in law school or my friends? Or, you know, like, I guess the question I have is, in your slice of law, what are the skill? I mean, I would assume there's skill sets that make you really good at your expertise, but would those necessarily transfer to if you wanted to be a divorce attorney or a real estate attorney, it feels like they're very different skill sets.
Yes, I mean, I think across the board, this profession, any profession, to do your best, it's got to be something you enjoy and you're passionate about, and you've got kind of a self-motivating energy for. I mean, it's a competitive world out there, and people expect a lot out of you in whatever field or profession. And if it's not something that you're kind of passionate about and you have that inner self-drive to be your best, most inspired, creative professional, it's hard to really do well. As far as skills for this, you know, some people may be dissuaded by going to law school, you know, gosh, it's so much schooling, but I, you know, it's different than becoming a physician where you've got 4 years of medical school, you've got residency, you've got subspecialties. You know, law school, you got your four-year college degree, I mean, to practice law, but your four-year college degree, you go to law school 3 years. I mean, that frankly goes by pretty quickly. And, you know, then you're out and you can practice. There's a couple areas where you can get a, what they call an LLM, a master's in masters of law. That's really tax law and patent law, which are kind of distinct specialties. But beyond that, I think as far as the skills, it does take some, certainly some academic work and analytical, logical skills. Certainly, you've got to be a good writer because so much of it is determined in your written negotiations, your briefings. It certainly helps, I think, to be well spoken and articulate. You're obviously your word has to be good. Your reputation and your word, your representations have to be absolutely ironclad. And you've got to be, I think, good at dealing with people. And if people like you, they like working with you, enjoy corresponding with you, that just helps.
Yeah.
So much all the way through. I had a law school professor one time say, you know, some of the traits that make us a good lawyer don't necessarily make us a good person. And one thing my dad always harped into me is be respectful to the clerks, be respectful to the bailiffs, everybody along the way. Never let your reputation for truthfulness be anything but impeccable. You know, it takes years to build your reputation. You can lose it in one phone call, one statement to the court, one pleading. And so to be a successful attorney, you don't have to be the smartest. You don't have to be the most articulate. You don't have to be the best writer. A passion and a combination of those things, I think, is what serves the most successful people the best.
Like, knowing you, I'm going to say Eddie. Edmund doesn't.
Yeah. Absolutely, doesn't, my friend. You're grandfathered in.
Doesn't sound right, but I know in another world it would be Edmund. So, like, I've always, like, you're very easy to talk to socially. You've always been very likable. And I would assume that there's, you know, not everybody has those skills, right? Maybe there's introverts or people that are book smart and they're not real comfortable being out in front of people speaking. There are roles or there are areas of law that maybe if you're not great talking or interacting or you don't have you can't read a room socially, there are opportunities for people in other areas, correct?
Oh, most absolutely. I mean, I make no bones about the fact that there's plenty of people that are smarter, better writers, more well-read than me. I think there's litigation work and then there's so much transactional work. It's kind of an oversimplification on my part, I think, to split it up just that way. But there's so many people that will be of tremendous service to their clients, businesses, individuals through, you know, legal research, through contract negotiation, through regulation compliance. I mean, you'll think about mergers and acquisition attorneys that have to master a substantial amount of regulatory, minutia, for lack of a better word, have to comb through lots and lots of documents, have to analyze legal issues and give opinions. Some attorneys that will work for law firms representing corporate clients, some of them will oftentimes branch off and be corporate counsel to those individual companies. In those situations, you'll have employment and HR issues come up. Depending on the nature of the business, there's sometimes securities or regulatory issues, government funding, government contract type issues, certainly general contract issues all the way through. But at 100%, people that are maybe a little more introverted absolutely will have opportunities in the legal field if that's what they choose to and are passionate about doing. I think, quite frankly, maybe my willingness to talk to people probably covers up some, academic shortcomings, perhaps. But there's absolutely roles for people who maybe are a little more introverted, maybe a little more, book or academically focused, and they're tremendously successful.
I think the point I'm making, if you're watching, is like my wife right now is, I think she's watching, it's called Suits. It's a Netflix. And it, I remember Tom Cruise in The Firm and, Matthew McConaughey in another movie. And, you see what you, the sexy turn, in terms of like, it's exciting. It's, but at the end of the day, I think there's a lot of different ways you can jump into the profession based on your unique personality type. And it doesn't have to be the guy who's really, or the woman who's really attractive and speaks well and everybody seems to like them. I mean, I just think there's different, so it shouldn't be a deterrent. One of the questions I'm thinking that I don't want to forget about is if somebody's preparing to go against you and like, what makes you good at what you do? Like if there, and I know it's hard to compliment yourself, but if there's like two or three things that Edmund is really good at, or someone is going against you and they're, they're trying to figure out how to win, like what would you say you bring to the table?
So I guess looking at my criminal cases, I will kind of think forward how the legal issues would play out at trial and how those same things will play out in late stage negotiations with the prosecuting attorney.
Got it.
I have a lot of cases against my old colleagues in the King County Prosecutor's Office, and certainly knowing them well helps. I know so many of the judges, and again, they're going to make fair rulings based on whatever is in front of them, but having the respect of people you've worked with, I think, helps along the way. Also, knowing what you need to do along the way to get your best outcome, whether that's, preserving evidence, getting a private investigator on board to get surveillance video from the apartment complex where a stabbing happened, where the police have one side of it, but really there was a bunch more that happened that caused the person to act in self-defense instead. There's a wild injury accident, getting an investigator out there to get traffic cam footage. Sometimes knowing when not to get that because you don't think it's going to be helpful and you think it's probably going to make things worse. Oftentimes, people accused of a crime, there's underlying issues, mental health, alcohol, drugs, anger, domestic violence. Getting people going in the direction of addressing those issues, because one thing the prosecutors want to see is they want to see that you're taking good faith attempts to address whatever underlying issues led somebody to find themselves charged with that crime, whether it's, you know, an ugly traffic accident with injuries, whether it's, you know, repeat DUI, whether it's domestic violence, whether it's, you know, someone who repeatedly might steal from high-end stores when they've got absolutely no real reason to do so, whether it's somebody who has trouble in their relationships that ends up in threats or alleged assaults. You see people from all backgrounds. I mean, people come back from, you know, service overseas in the military, and they have, you know, challenges that we can't really even comprehend. So getting them hooked up with services, is very helpful to kind of show a good faith attempt. That coupled with showing the prosecutor what potential legal challenges are going to be, you know, problems with the blood draw that the cops took, problems with the breath test and the way the machine was administered or the way the records were kept, or, you know, we've got, there's an issue right now where the state patrol, you know, somebody gets arrested for a DUI, they'll take a blood sample for somebody that doesn't take the breath test, or if it's a felony case, the police can take blood without your consent. And, you know, they store it in these huge refrigerators at the State Patrol Crime Lab in South Downtown. And there was a power outage for about 6 or 7 days last year, where literally a couple thousand blood samples were in that and they weren't kept at the proper temperature. And then there's an argument that because they haven't been stored properly, they can't be used as evidence in the case. You kind of want to avoid getting down the path of, well, did the 7 day lack of temperature really change what the blood result would be and make it inaccurate? It's more, these are the procedures that have to be followed for the blood test to be admitted into evidence. These weren't followed. Blood tests should be excluded from evidence for that reason.
Okay. I want to jump in. Yeah. I don't mean to interrupt you, but like when you're talking, like what I'm hearing or feeling from you is like you have a lot of experience and credibility. Like you've seen a lot of things. And so like if you, there's 20 Edmonds and I'm trying to figure out which attorney I want to hire, I'm thinking, okay, this is a guy that has a lot of experience. If we were just kind of switch gears a little bit, like what is it about you personally? Like, do you have a unique skill or a comparative advantage over other attorneys? Cause I know there's other people that do what you do. So how are you marketing yourself and differentiating yourself from your competitors?
No, that's a great question. I mean, quite honestly, I do almost no marketing, and probably any reputable business advisor would say that's foolish, but almost all of my cases come from referrals from other attorneys or other clients. I've got a real good network of attorneys that will refer me cases just because we've worked together in the past and they've been happy with how things have turned out. And it does help that I'm from this area and I've got a lot of friends. And a little of a bit of an aside, but one of the reasons I like being a sole practitioner on my own is I've got friends who I help out on tiny little things, writing a letter to somebody, you know, maybe a traffic ticket that I don't handle as part of my practice, but I will for friends, family members, that sort of thing. Letters to business partners, a dispute with an auto repair shop. But as far as how I market myself, I think, you know, it kind of sounds old fashioned, but if you do a good job for people and you keep them informed and you let them know what's going to be happening. See, one of the biggest challenges, somebody's charged with the crime and they've never been through it before. They're frantic about, you know, am I going to go to jail? Am I going to lose my license? Is this going to be on my record? Is this going to keep me from getting this job? Am I going to lose my medical license? Am I going to lose my mortgage license? Am I going to lose my commercial driver's license, let alone my regular driver's license? Is this going to keep me from graduate school? Trying to work through that in manageable chunks and letting them know kind of what I expect and the timeline that those things will happen and then what we can do to ultimately work out our best outcome. I think by doing that and people feel a little better and more assured, I think, you know, kind of, you know, you talk about the bedside man, right? That's been helpful in me having real good relationships with my clients. And it also is kind of necessary for them to buy into my strategy for handling the case along the way. Because if you're not on the same page and you're constantly fighting with them when, you know, they want to push the case forward to trial, when you know that's not a good idea, and you know that, hey, let's continue it out a few more months while we finish your alcohol treatment, while we pay off the damage to whatever happened, you know, someone's maybe going to be witness moving out of state, whatever. It's helpful to be on the same page with your clients. So
I get it. No, I mean, it's interesting. So many of the different careers that I've interviewed people on, there, it's the consistent theme is just likability. It's a people skills. Even like when I did a podcast with some music composers, you know, one of them was saying like, it's really important to have strong relationships. You got to get out there and network and rub shoulders with people. And, you know, those communication skills, you know, no matter what profession you're in, obviously illegal, but they're just consistent. You need to be able to relate to people, which is interesting. What would you say to somebody like, is there anything, I don't want to say be negative, but is there anything you would warn people on? Like if someone was dead set on getting into law, would you like say, hey, great, but you need to think about this, this, or this, like maybe warn them against, like, let's say you had a child and they're like, hey, dad, I really want to do what you're doing. I know you have a daughter in college. Like, what if she was dead set on following in your footsteps? Is there anything you would warn her on?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You know, to have an in-depth conversation, I'd maybe want to know a little more about which direction someone is looking to go. If somebody wants to be on law review, top 10% of their class, get a job at Perkins Coie, one of the top firms, you know, in town. I mean, that's great, but there's a lot of billable hours. There's a lot of expectations, and it's going to be a grind. You work for the prosecutor's office or the public defender's office. You get a lot of great trial experience. You don't have to worry about billable hours. You don't have to worry about, you know, any sort of business aspect of it all. But, you know, there's, you know, it's a grind and you're in court a lot. One thing you do deal with a lot of tragedy and a lot of sadness and a lot of loss. You know, you think about vehicular homicide, vehicular assault cases where people have been killed or very badly injured in car accidents or, you know, shootings or stabbings or assaults, you know, sexual assault cases. I don't do any sex case defense in my practice. I choose not to, and I've gotten to the point where I can pick and choose the cases I want, clients I want. There's a number of attorneys in town, including some of my colleagues in my office suite here that are experts at that, and I'm happy to refer those cases on. But still, there's a lot of uncertainty, and you got to deal with a lot of emotional, you know, challenges and uncertainties kind of shouldered on to you. But one of the things I tell people is, hey, one of the things that you're going to get if we choose to work together on this case is I'm going to try and alleviate as much certainty as I can. Obviously, you know, I know you want me to say, hey, write me this check for the retainer. I'm going to snap my fingers and make this go away. But that's not how it works, and I'd be doing you a disservice if I wasn't upfront and honest about how I think this will play out, how long I think it's maybe going to take. But I will keep you informed every step of the way, and I'll answer your questions, and, you know, I'm happy to talk with you about this anytime. So there is a lot of personal challenge. You deal with some difficult folks, no question about it. You know, in the prosecutor's office, there's a hierarchy, and there's, you know, the people that kind of kiss up to the supervisors along the way, like there is in probably most industries. You'd have that in law and in law firms as well. But you want to look at the benefits, but you do need to be mindful of the challenges. I mean, that's, you know, it's, you know, it's stressful when you've got high stakes litigation. You know that if you stayed up and researched and wrote your brief for another 3 hours till 10 o'clock at night, you could do better. Sometimes you have to do that. Sometimes that's not the case, but you have to be prepared to do that when you're called on.
I'm just thinking, like, years ago, I went back to school for psychology and I thought I wanted to work with kids, and it was really heavy, like a lot of the stuff we would get into. And I realized it probably wasn't the right temperament environment for me. But like in law, and I'm speaking to the people watching this, it's like, I think it's really important to get hold of kind of the uniqueness of who you are, how you deal with pressure, stress. Like a lot of the stuff you deal with is heavy. But I assume if that's hard for somebody, maybe real estate law wouldn't be as heavy, or I don't know, employment law or something like that. But it's important to think about. Is there anything that, I know you like what you do, but is there anything you strongly dislike about your career?
You know, they sound a little trivial, but working for myself, dealing with the technology issues on my own without having a, you know, IT guy at your beck and call like you would at a law firm or the prosecutor's office. But I've got people I work with on that. I mean, being my own boss and working for myself and just taking the cases I want and the clients I want, I've really gotten to be fond of that. And that's why, you know, last 19 years, I've had a lot of people say, hey, man, hire an associate and get a local guy or local woman who just graduated from law school and knows people, and you can pawn a lot of that work off. And, you know, there's some advantage to that, and that's, you know, probably good advice. But I'm able to run my practice so efficiently, and I'm able to devote all my time on the cases I choose. And clients like to know that I'm going to handle every aspect of their case. I'll be the one making every court appearance. I'll be the one that they deal with directly on it. And it's allowed me the flexibility to, you know, help coach my kids' teams when they were younger, get away for a long weekend, get away when there's a Christmas party or a Thanksgiving Day thing at their school and do that. So I've liked the flexibility. Now, the flip side is, you know, you got to hustle to keep it coming in the top as fast as it's going out the bottom. So you do sometimes have to be a slave to your phone because things happen at weird times. And, you know, it's not unusual. I get a call over the weekend, something happened and someone's in custody, and we're talking to the family on Sunday night because they've got a very important bail hearing in custody on Monday morning somewhere. But that's kind of, you know, that's kind of just part of it. If I don't feel like paying attention to my phone, I won't, but I do have to be mindful of that because you'll miss out on calls and potential cases because people aren't waiting around. I mean, they're freaking out. Something happened. They got court tomorrow morning. They don't get a hold of you within a few minutes or calling the next person.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people think, oh God, I want to be my own boss. I want to have my own company, start my own whatever. There's a lot of, which is cool, but there's a lot that you got to do that maybe isn't so public. Like there's, you know, doing your own IT, doing your own books, writing your bills
for taxes.
Yeah. Even in my world, like in lending, like a lot of people go out on their own, but they don't realize it involves 15 things they got to do. And sometimes it's just easier to work for a larger company. As far as your profession and just getting into the personal. So you have your profession and then you have, you know, personal life. It feels like, correct me if I'm wrong, but these are the things that I want people to think about. Sounds like working for yourself, you have freedom, you have control of your schedule. Sounds like you don't really have to deal with politics. Like if you work for a big firm and they want you to get vaccinated and you don't believe in the vaccination, like it sounds like there's benefits there. Income, I would assume working for yourself, you have the ability to take more of that profit. Is there, I mean, am I right or am I wrong on any of those things? It's like,
oh, you're 100% right. Now, I kind of wouldn't have thought to mention the political part of it, but you're right on the money, Dirk. I have people talk to me all the time about, you know, a lot of friends of mine that are judges. They can't be heard to say anything out of turn, any post on social media, because it could come back to them. People working in the prosecutor's office, they've got to be so careful about what they say. Sometimes they're pressed on things. After the George Floyd kind of reckoning a few years ago, a bunch of prosecutors got together, kind of voiced their displeasure with, you know, the decades-long practice of being so supportive of police in their prosecutions. Public defenders had, you know, were speaking out about things, but there's backlash with that. I've had friends in small businesses where they have employees demanding that they take a side on the Hamas-Israel thing, that they either support or denounce certain positions that have been taken between Russia and Ukraine. And I couldn't be more delighted that I can completely stand on the sidelines and nobody's pushing me. And what I tell people is, you know, there, whatever you say, you're going to disappoint somebody. So work hard to fight for your ability to keep your opinions to yourself and not be forced to put something out there that's going to, you know, cause a problem one way or the other. Now, you've got a personally, if you've got a very deep-seated, passionate reason that you want to speak out, I certainly would have the ability to do that. And there's no boss, nobody could hold that against me, except it could potentially, you know, deter future clients from pursuing representation. But I do like the ability to be able to completely stay on the sidelines or speak up to the extent I like to. Now, being on my own, I like that. I'm in an office suite with several other attorneys that are all former prosecutor colleagues of mine. That's tremendously beneficial. You can't be your best, at least me, you can't be your best professional, really anything, without support from others. And the amount of time we'll, you know, collaborate on things or walk down the hall and talk about this legal issue, or, hey, I got to write a brief on this. Didn't you brief this issue last year? Yeah, here's my brief. Tweak it as you need to. Intel on certain prosecutors, certain judges' rulings. It helps immensely to have a group of supportive professionals, even if they're not in your same firm. But, you know, you hear lawyers talking about, well, you know, I'm not really going to need the office myself. I'll just meet clients at Starbucks or something like that. I personally think having my own office that I can go to is, you know, invaluable. Nice, yeah, to get out of the house, do my own thing. I've got professionals around. I'm a couple blocks from the courthouse. So I don't know if that really answers your question necessarily, but those are some advantages and ways that you can mitigate some of the, you know, realities of being on your own.
I think it's huge. I mean, it's like, I mean, I think that that's the stuff why I do this podcast is I don't think young adults are thinking about those things, but I also know you change as you grow older, like you become, you develop stronger opinions. Like when I was young, I never really thought about the importance of waking up with my kids, going to bed with them, coaching their sports, missing holidays. But that's one of my number one thing. That's kind of why I got into lending, is I didn't want to travel anymore. And I used to work in technology and I just wanted to be present and around my family, which is kind of my number one thing. And those aren't things that maybe people are conscious about when they're young. But just listening to you, I think this is really good, because some people kind of like to, you know, follow, you know, I don't mean this in the negative, but some people are sheep. They just follow and they just do whatever. And then there's people that have opinions, and, you know, maybe those types of people wouldn't do well in a big corporation, you know, that has a lot of politics and rules and so forth. So compensation, I'm not asking you, Eddie, what you make, but how does an attorney has his own or her own practice? Like, do you get, if you take on a case, is it typically a flat fee or is it a percentage of what the settlement is, or does it just vary?
So, you know, so that's a great question. I'll take cases a number of different ways. Generally, my criminal defense cases will be a flat fee plus a trial fee. So just for representation, it's X amount, and that's going to cover everything. Unless we actually go to trial, then it's going to be X amount more. My personal injury cases, I'll take those on a contingency where we're eventually going to bring a lawsuit against the individual, but really their insurance company who injured somebody, and somebody was injured through no fault of their own. When we're going to be getting money in on the back end through a settlement, well, I'll take that on a contingency. Kind of the standard in the industry is a 1/3 contingency, but if litigation is filed and you have to go to court on it, then it's 40%. But that, say, it'd be basically we're taking all the risk. We're fronting the time. And if we don't recover anything, we don't make any money. And that keeps the individual from having to come out of pocket for any attorney's fees at the outset. And oftentimes they're injured, they can't work, they're looking at mounting medical bills. And then we're all equally incentivized to do well. I do have a number of cases that I'll take on an hourly basis. An instance would be if I'm being paid by somebody other than the client. I've had cases where people's employers have paid, sometimes small businesses, sometimes bigger businesses. I'll generally bill them by the hour. I've had cases where, say, the Catholic Archdiocese has paid me directly. I'll bill them by the hour just because that's a little bit easier. And usually I'm dealing with one of their corporate counsel through the course of this. And I know that that's going to be a more secure source of payment as opposed to sending somebody a bill after the fact. Sometimes if I've had cases where someone will have money seized from them, say they're going through the airport, and the cops find, you know, 120 grand in a bag. And occasionally I'll take those on a contingency where they don't really want to pay any more money, thinking they might not get anything back. But I'll say, okay, I'll tell you what, we'll split, you know, 1/3, 2/3, however much we get back from the Port of Seattle or Seattle Police Department or something like that.
So there's flexibility. I mean, it's not black and white. I've never been happy or content where I'm fixed, where, you know, this is what you're going to make no matter how much you put into it. It sounds like in your career, there's a lot of upside. And I know you don't go into it just for the money, but if somebody is interested in earning income and making as much as they can, it sounds like you have that ability if you're in private practice.
Hey, absolutely. Absolutely. And so, when you're working for the county or you're working for a law firm, generally you've got your salary. And some people have been hesitant or afraid kind of to go out on their own. Where are you going to get your clients? But honestly, after I had, you know, done my time in the prosecutor's office and thinking ahead, you know, we're having kids. My wife is probably going to be staying home with them. We want to be able to travel. We want to get a, you know, boat. It's expensive to live in Seattle. Honestly, the thought of being limited to living on what my salary was going to be got to be exponentially more stressful than being able to go into private practice and really be in control of how much I could make. And, you know, talking about the different fee arrangements, there's ethical rules that set out certain requirements, certain fee agreements have to be in writing and so forth. Obviously, they got to be reasonable. There's provisions for refunds in certain situations. So, you know, obviously I abide by those rules, but there's definitely the opportunity. And I've been able to do well financially over the years. You know, you got to build up your practice and your kind of goodwill out there, but I'm in a position now where I'm making substantially more than I would if I was still in the prosecutor's office, even with the salary bump ups over all these years.
Is there a recurring revenue? And what I mean by that, are there opportunities for you to get paid year in and year out by a certain client, like on retainer, or is there always a time where it ends?
You know, that's a good question. Not really so much in the way of recurring things. A lot of lawyers do, if they're on retainer for certain business practices that are continuing issues. The criminal cases are usually one-time deals, and you get paid on that case. You know, sometimes people have future issues down the road, and those might be clients coming in, but as people accumulate more criminal history, cases get a little tougher, and there's a little less goodwill from the parents and uncles and others supporting them. So I've had a lot of repeat clients over the years, but that's not really something you count on as much. The personal injury cases, again, those are kind of just a one-time thing. You get those, you work through those, you hopefully get a good settlement. So you got to keep a number of those in the pipeline, but it's not really recurring sources of direct revenue. So I do need to continue to market and be receptive to new calls and be willing to kind of drop what I'm doing to meet with somebody or talk with somebody and take a look at new cases. Somebody calls me on a new case, I'll ask them about it. I'll get online. I'll look at the pleadings. I'll look at the allegations. And, you know, if it's in a county that's going to be a pain to deal with, if the individual seems like they're going to be a pain or they're unrealistic, then I'll kind of shy away from that. Yeah. But it's pretty much case by case by case by case. Unlike a lot of attorneys who have clients that will continue to pay them for recurring services.
So as we wind down, I have a few questions. One that just popped in my mind, just because I did a podcast just recently with Richard A. Jones, is a judge who you know, who is highly respected and a really, really nice man. How important is it that judges like you? Like, do you ever like see a case and you're going to get a specific judge and maybe they don't like you for a reason? I mean, is that, or judges so non-biased that that doesn't really matter?
Well,
does that make sense? Am I explaining?
No. I mean, Dirk, that's such a good question. It's something I think about all the time.
Right.
I mean, really, I would say judges are very intelligent, solid, smart, unbiased professionals that work hard to be fair and do the right thing. I mean, that said, they're human beings. And if I walk into a courtroom in a rural county where I've never seen this judge before, you know, I'd like to think that I'd make a good professional impression and presentation and they would be respectful. But you compare that to walking into a courtroom in King County Superior Court where the judge was a colleague of mine for years in the prosecutor's office, and we had beers after trials and we compared notes on things and we played on the prosecutor's office softball team together and we were maybe at each other's weddings or things like that. I think it can't help but have some benefit, not necessarily in the rulings that you're going to get, but the way they're going to treat you, the way they're going to respect you, the way they know you by name. And that carries a benefit, you know, in front of your client and then certainly in front of the prosecutor or opposing counsel. So I ultimately think those personal relationships are very valuable and very beneficial.
I love it. Big question I always ask is, you know, is there something that I haven't asked? Because I'm not an attorney. This is not my world, but, or maybe it's advice. Again, think about the audience that's watching and somebody's either running away from doing what you do, or they're interested. Is there any advice before somebody commits? And it, you know, it's 3 years of law school is 3 years of law school, right? I mean, that's a lot of time, in my opinion, not as much as, you know, becoming a doctor, but what it takes to become a doctor. But what advice would you give to somebody that's maybe seriously thinking about pursuing your specific type of law and they're just not sure?
Yeah. You know, again, another great question, Dirk. I mean, try to learn as much as you can, and the service that you're providing people and the benefit and the wisdom and the exposure, I think is tremendous. And, you know, getting out and talking to people, don't be afraid to reach out to somebody, you know, that you see on LinkedIn, or, you know, you've got a buddy whose dad's a doctor or mom's an attorney, or don't be afraid to reach out to them and, hey, can we have a chat? Can we go get coffee? Can we talk about this? I'm thinking about doing this, you know, talk to people. I mean, certainly what you see on TV inspires people because it looks so, you know, glamorous. I mean, you see these, you know, well-dressed, articulate, attractive attorneys doing these trials that seem to get all the way to closing arguments in a 30-minute show, but it's not showing the months of pretrial motions, working on all the evidence and chasing the witnesses down and doing all that. But talk to people that are doing it. There's lots of resources out there now, especially in our social media age. And I frankly, I love talking to high school kids or college kids or even, you know, law school aspirants or law school students. I judged a mock trial for the high school mock trial program. I judged that a couple of weeks ago in the courthouse. And I mean, those kids, those high school kids were so good, so talented, so practiced, so well prepared. It was a pleasure. And I talked to a number of them afterwards and I encouraged them, hey, feel free to give me a call, reach out anytime if you ever have any questions about this. So getting input from somebody who doesn't have any sort of agenda or vested interest other than wanting to give you good, fair advice about their own experience. I think is invaluable. And just, you know, there's a lot out there online to research about, but don't be shy about talking to people. Don't, oh God, I don't know this person. It's going to be weird. I get a text out of the blue or an email out of the blue. I mean, we want young practitioners that are helpful. We want to attract the best and the brightest into the field. We don't want to see people that don't want to do it and are going to be dissatisfied and unhappy and facing, you know, some debt. But I think I speak for so many practitioners that would be delighted to talk to anyone. So don't be shy about that. I guess that's one bit of advice I'd give.
I love it. What about, along those lines, what about expediting the process about trying to figure out what type of law somebody might, like, I believe like this podcast is like, what are you naturally good at? Like, what were you born in this world? Like, what are you better at than more people? Or what do people come to you for? Like, we all have kind of our unique skills and interests and passions. And I guess the question is, if someone's pretty dead set on becoming an attorney, is there an exercise or a process that you would recommend as far as trying to zero in on maybe the type of law, like that's natural, like you were naturally interested in yours, I think maybe a little bit because of your dad and some of the stories you grew up hearing. But like, is there something that you would say to somebody when they say, I want to be an attorney, but I don't know what kind of law I want to do? Is there any advice you'd give to somebody to try to figure that out?
Yeah. You know, kind of be a student of the world, be mindful of what's going on in the world, on a small scale and also on a big scale, and see which issues you may be passionate about. I mean, some people are very passionate about the environment. Some are passionate about social justice causes. Some are passionate about political causes. And that might kind of inform you. You know, you'll hear people say, oh yeah, so-and-so is a good arguer, they should go to law school. I mean, that's kind of part of it, but I think it's more, the ability to advocate certainly is important, but the desire to help people, the desire and the willingness to see somebody in a difficult situation, because no one's coming to lawyers. Nobody wants to pay a lawyer unless they absolutely have to. So people aren't coming to lawyers just to, hey, let's hang out and, you know, let me pay you for your time. But if you like the idea of having somebody coming to you, trust you, working through their problem, and there's a tremendous feeling of satisfaction. I've gotten, you know, the nicest cards and letters and hugs and thanks. And, you know, I get a huge handful of texts on Christmas and New Year's and Father's Day. A lot of these numbers I don't even recognize. I got to go back 4 years on my text thing. Oh, yeah. That was so-and-so that I helped out on the case. But just be, you know, think about what personality traits you have and what appeals to you. And don't be afraid if you're interested in the idea generally, don't be afraid to go to law school. Your first year law school courses will be property, torts, contracts, criminal law, civil procedure, things like that. And you'll read case law. Your professors are going to be pretty intense, and you'll get to know different areas of the law. And then you'll get to meet people in the different areas of law. And then there's a lot of internship programs that you can have during law school. And then by your second year in law school, when you finish 60 of your 90 credits, you can go into court and you can try cases. I mean, you know, criminal misdemeanors once you've had a little bit of supervision. But I mean, I probably had done 15 jury trials by the time I even sat to take the bar. And granted, they're all misdemeanors in the city of Kent, you know, driving cases, DUIs, bar fights, you know, misdemeanor DV assaults, hit and runs. But that's good experience, and I enjoyed that. But there's a lot of exposure during your 3 years of law school to different areas that can inform what you want to do. And a lot of people will change. And hey, I want to go into environmental law. Next thing you know, they're working for the public defender's office, or they're working for some, big corporation, or doing a lot of different things. So a lot of people change along the way. I don't think it's necessary to have a clear direction in mind, and I don't think it's necessarily ideal to be bound to that if other things intrigue you more.
I love it. No, that's really good advice. And you answered that perfectly. Two last questions. They're kind of quick. I love movies, and there's so many legal movies, and, you know, like, is there one that, like, just being an attorney that over the years, like, is there one that's your favorite, one that sticks out that you will watch three or four times? Just kind of curious, being a lawyer, is there a law movie that you love?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. There's so many I'm thinking about. The old Perry Mason movies where he kind of is a detective on cross-exam and breaks the witness down. That rarely happens in real life, but it's so fun to see how he'll do that in those old movies. The TV shows Law and Order. I mean, I like New York, and that's interesting. That's my favorite of all the legal TV shows. I know, not a movie, because someone will be walking down the street, they'll find a body behind a dumpster, or, you know, a floater in the East River, or, you know, in a car or in a cab. And then you look and you're like, you know, a couple of civilians happen upon it, or a couple of officers walking their beat, or somebody running through Central Park in the morning. You're like, oh my Lord, how are they going to sort this out? How are they going to figure this out? And then, you know, they'll start putting together the clues and the pieces, and it's going to lead them in one direction or another. Then they start talking to certain people, and they do some forensic evidence, and hey, you know, there's soil in these people's boots that isn't indigenous to the area, or there's some security footage over here, or the contents of the stomach in the autopsy say that, you know, puts them in a particular place. And then following the evidence, and again, this is TV, so it's got to be nicely contained in a 60-minute episode. And then all of a sudden somebody's arrested, and then you get the attorney on board. There's all this posturing between the DAs and the defense attorneys, and then it ends up in trial, and usually, you know, Jack McCoy or the DA wins. But it's pretty fascinating to kind of see how those play out, because they do touch on a lot of issues with, you know, stock dumps and social media and, you know, human trafficking and different things like that. So that's probably the one that's the most intriguing. The movie The Firm, I really liked. I read all those John Grisham books. I'm not a huge reader socially because I read so much for work, but I love John Grisham, and I read all those books, and I love the legal maneuverings and the bright, young, creative characters that he introduces in those books. And so The Firm was one of my favorite movies.
I love the firm. Last question. So let's just say your whole legal chapter ends, you retire, whatever. Is there a and I ask this question because I think it's always interesting for me to, what would be a dream job for you? Like if you had to, I mean, retiring is one way, but let's just say you could do anything you want. Are you doing it, or is there another career that you would love to be able to spend time doing?
You know, that's interesting. I mean, I think unlike my dad and, you know, his generation, he worked full time. Then when his office lease ended and he decided to retire, you know, boom, that was it. And he went from full time to retired, you know, with the turn of the calendar page. Because of technology and my flexibility, and I can make a lot of my court appearances virtually, and obviously, you know, I don't need to be in the office to talk on the phone with somebody. I'll probably phase out to some extent and just take the cases that are going to be a little more attractive and work around my schedule some. You know, I still feel like I'm pretty young and healthy, and so I don't want to be just idle. I mean, I like doing stuff on my boat. I like working on the house. I like working on our place up at Woodby. I like working in the yard, but I think I'd get a little unfulfilled with that. I mean, maybe being an adjunct law professor at a law school, maybe a professor or something of undergrad. But okay. I probably wouldn't be inclined to go back to school, but if I could teach something in the legal profession, something like that. I mean, I like coaching. I like working with, you know, with kids, maybe something along those lines. It's a great question. I honestly haven't given it too much thought.
Yeah, no worries. I didn't know if it was going to be like a break dancer or an actor or a, you know, or a chef or something. It's always interesting because I've gotten some interesting responses. All right. So we're going to end this thing. I wanted to say thanks so much for coming on. Is there anything I didn't ask that you feel like you want to say, or are you pretty good?
Really, Dirk, just to say thank you for doing what you're doing. You're doing a tremendous service to people out there, and you never know whose lives you're going to touch with one connection, one view. And you look at all the different forks in the road you have in life that impact your course one way or the other, and you never know what those are going to be. And I'm so thankful to so many incredible people along the way that have helped me over the years. You know, when I'm in school, my dad was impactful, but, you know, his friends, his colleagues, young attorneys, you know, supervisors I had in the different prosecutor's offices I worked, you know, colleagues, judges taking me aside. You know, you mentioned Judge Jones. What an incredible gentleman he is. He's the coolest judge I know, the best judge I know. Had the pleasure of having a number of trials. He was good enough to be a professional reference for me when I was looking to get out of the prosecutor's office and was interviewing with different firms. And so I'm so thankful to so many people that helped me out, and I feel a responsibility to try to do the same to others when I can, and would encourage people to not be shy about that. I mean, there's a lot of good people out there, a lot of people that want to help young people succeed. It's a challenging world, but this young generation has amazing capabilities and talents that just weren't available to us and can provide a tremendous benefit. So, you know, I guess that's what I'd say, Dirk, and you're an all-star for doing what you're doing. It's been a privilege to be on here with you today.
I appreciate it. I enjoy talking to people who are good at what they do. And again, I think if you had data on how many hours or what percentage of your life is spent working, I think it's really important that people maybe think a little more about the next, you know, what they get themselves into. Because honestly, I don't think most people love what they do. And I think that's kind of sad. So, but I appreciate your time, Eddie. You were great. And have a good day. And then as far as just real quick, if somebody is interested in your services, what's the best way for them to contact you?
Oh, so I can give you my card. I've got a website. It's edallenlaw.com. That's not the most polished website, but it's got all my information.
Cool.
And I can give you my business card. I can send you one of those. Maybe you can put that up if need be. But that's got my office. It's got my cell. It's got my email.
I think your website's great. I think, yeah. And I remember you and I were talking, I think, earlier this week. And you got a call on the other line. And I know that you're quick to get back to people. So if you are interested in Eddie's services or you just want to maybe talk a little bit about the profession, I'm sure he would be more than happy to do that. And thanks so much for your time.
Hey, my pleasure. And don't be afraid to use my cell phone. If I'm tied up in something, I'll get back to you. But getting a text or getting a cell phone, getting a call on my cell phone, I don't mind that. That's part of the deal. But sure, great to be on here with you, my friend. And I thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it.
You bet.